Gonna, as soon as we get the crowd together, next person to talk to Bill dies. The Decker talk.
Well, Vern's out glad handing him.
Work session, yes. Senate Bill 230.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
I move the dash 5 amendments.
Okay, Senator Courtney moves the dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 230. Discussion.
Can we take a look at them?
Discussion. Any discussion?
Yeah, we're trying to find them, but.
Trust me, it's okay. Yeah. Everybody's for it. Yeah. Discussion. Just for the record, Mr. Stonebrake indicated he's got a letter he's going to provide. All the members, right. Do you have
it? It'll be coming.
It's there.
Okay. And although they have some.
Here's my copy. That's good.
They've worked with you, basically.
I'm not screwed.
Yeah. There should be a letter coming.
You're worried about everyone.
No further discussion?
Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 230 as amended to the Senate floor to do pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves Senate Bill 230 as amended to the floor of the Senate with a do pass recommendation. Discussion.
Is that letter available?
It is available, and they're going to make a copy of it.
You don't trust me. I told you, you're not going to get screwed on this.
I think the essence of this, and correct me if I'm wrong, Mr. Welch and Mr. Stonebrink are going to provide you with some information with their concerns that you'll incorporate in your floor speech so that people will be aware of what their issues are. Okay. All right. Any objections to the bill? Senator Byers noted as an objection.
What?
Any further objections? Hearing none. So ordered. Senator, would you like to carry a bill?
Yeah.
Hell yes, I do it all the time.
All right. You're being very distracted.
I'm sorry. I apologize.
All right. Work session, Senate Bill 914.
Mr. Chair, I move, are there amendments?
Is there a dash five
amendment? Mr. Mayor, I move the dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 914, Mr. Chair.
All right. Senator Courtney moves the dash 5 amendments to Senate Bill 914. Discussion. Kelsey, would you tell us what we're doing here with 914?
Yes. Mr. Chairman and members of the committee, this is the bill that Senator Deckard sponsored regarding drug treatment services. I wrote a summary of the dash 5 amendments, which are in your packet. The dash 5 amendments really rewrite the bill. It's still a drug treatment services bill. What this bill would do would direct the local public safety coordinating council to develop a drug treatment plan to integrate drug treatment into the criminal justice system for, and it would apply to offenders who commit nonviolent felonies, which would be possession, I'm assuming possession charges. I don't know if nonviolent felony would include any other charges, any other drug charges, and also property offenses. And then it really, the key part of it, I think, is then directs the Office of the Alcohol and Drug Abuse Programs to fund these plans with money from the Drug Prevention and Education Fund. If you look into the statute, or in the bill as it will amend create the statute, the Drug Prevention and Education Fund will be funded by monies from civil forfeitures. And the idea that is being put here is that it would allow a person to plead guilty on the offense that they're charged with. It would allow people who have, as I said, been charged with a possession or a drug crime or a property offense that is motivated by the offender's dependence on a controlled substance, and they would plead guilty. And if they completed a drug treatment program, judgment would never be entered, and the guilty plea would be discharged, so they would not be convicted if they completed that treatment program.
Okay. Senator Deckard, can you help me understand the relationship of the Drug Prevention Education Fund and then the property crimes element that's part of this?
Two separate issues. I mean,
they're two separate issues.
Two very separate issues.
All right. Okay, so how is it treating the property crimes?
And, Mr. Chair, the way that this is drafted, and thank you for the good explanation, Mr. Prinz, the way that this is drafted is it basically allows county by county, sets up what I would say is well thought of as a grant program, and allows counties through their local coordinating councils to compete for these grants. And then in the language we talk about, and it's all discretionary if the county chooses to go this route or not, but in the language, we basically lay out what
you would do to compete for these grants, or, and I'm not sure exactly what line it's on, but we did put in there.
Okay, but actually, I guess the answer to the question I'm finding here is property offenses that are motivated by an offender's dependence upon controlled substance. I guess that's, the question should have been, what's the nexus between the property crimes and drug offenses? So that's it.
Mm-hmm.
Any other discussion? Any objections to the adoption of these amendments?
Okay. Mr. Chair, I move Senate Bill 914 as amended to the Senate floor to do pass recommendation.
All right. Committee reporting moves Senate Bill 914 to the floor of the Senate with a do pass recommendation as amended by this committee. Discussion. And I want to, actually, this is a bill that the committee remembers. It came in, and just there were people all over the map. And Ryan Decker did a great job of getting people together, getting them to agree. Really did. I mean, I haven't had, other than there's been one person who's come to me who said they still have a problem with some of the amendments here. So at least that's pretty substantial. Discussion? Any further discussion? Any objections? No objections? Done.
Thank
and
you.
I assume you want to carry this bill too.
I'd love to.
Thank you, Senator.
Can I say one thing, Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir, you can.
Just want to thank the chair of the committee for helping us organize that work group. And there's many of the folks that are in here representing about every specter of this issue, from the prosecutors to law enforcement to the drug and alcohol treatment folks to the seizure, the proponents of Measure 3 on the forfeiture issue. And we had two very, very good meetings and did change the bill rather substantively, but want to thank all the folks that are in this room that came from all over Oregon. You'd ask that the judges be involved, and they sent a representative, and I'm just very appreciative of all the work that they put into this piece of legislation.
Good. Thank you, Senator. Appreciate your time. All righty. Do we have a representative of Jackie Winter's bill? Okay. If we could get, could you call Representative Winter's office? Ask them if she intended to speak on 2663. In the meantime, I want to go to a public hearing on House Bill 2096, dealing with executions, not education, but executions. And who do we have here for that bill? All right, and do we have a little, kind of like a love-in group here? And, okay, everybody who's wants to be part of this?
We'll hold hands.
Okay. So let's see, we see the ACLU, the broadcasters.
Corrections,
the steel state.
Interesting.
Well, who is going to start? Nick?
Chairman, member of the committee, I'm Nick Armenicus from the Oregon Department of Corrections. I'm here to provide information and support for House Bill 2096. It was introduced at the request of the Department of Corrections. Over the past 3 months, the department worked closely with legislative employees, employee representatives, and representatives of media to address concerns about media viewing of executions. The A and Gross version of the bill before the committee specifies that representatives from the media shall be invited to view executions. The bill also provides for persons present at the execution to view the initial execution procedures prior to the actual administer of the lethal injection by means of a simultaneous closed-circuit television transmission under the control of the superintendent. We believe this legislation provides the department a viable means of protecting the identities of correctional personnel and identification of potential retribution for participating in the execution process. At the same time, the representatives of the media will be able to view initial executions procedures that witnesses were not permitted to see in 1996 and 97. That concludes my testimony.
All right. Thank you. Brian?
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Brian DeLashman, representing the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees. As Nick has indicated, this bill in its present form is a compromise that was reached by all of the parties, and you see the wide variety of parties at this table. Our concern going in on 2096 from the perspective of the correctional employees was an open and full viewing of the procedure may in fact lead to either the disclosure of the identity of participating officers, which in a confined space like the correctional facility could lead to retribution against them by other inmates, or identification that could lead to some kind of a retribution against the family and that individual officer by the family or friends of the prisoner. We believe in its present form in 2096 that most of those issues have been resolved. The limitation, obviously, of seeing it from the pre-administration of the medication to conclusion in a closed-circuit situation, which was the brainchild of Representative Carl Wilson on the House side as a way to resolve the issue, I think was inspired, and we hope it works as well as we anticipate it will. Thank you.
Thank you, Brian. Mr. Strobeck.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. For the record, Ken Strobeck today representing the Oregon Association of Broadcasters. We participated along with the folks from the newspapers in the work group, and as Brian and Nick have already said, we started out quite different points on the beginning of the process on this bill, ended up in a place where we're all very comfortable with the outcome, feel like it satisfies the need for the corrections folks to have their identity protected, as well as allows the process to be open enough to have the media present as witnesses for the public, representing the watchdog role of the media in these situations. So we are here to speak in complete support of the bill and urge your passage.
All right. Great. Andrea?
Chair, members of the committee, Andrea Meyer, legislative director for the ACLU of Oregon. We, too, support the engrossed version of this bill. And our concern was ensuring that the media representatives representing citizens of the state of Oregon can witness the entire execution to ensure that it is done correctly. And that bill, as before you today, carries out that intention, and we support it. Thank you.
Could you define done correctly?
Chairman, it is our belief that the public needs to ensure that when the government takes this most awesome power of taking another person's life, that it is done safely and humanely, and that those who are there to witness it on behalf of the citizens of Oregon can ensure that the government is, when it carries out this most awesome power, is doing it that what manner.
It's actually a good answer.
Thank you.
Thank you. I like that. Okay. Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate the work that's been done on this bill, and I think it does, as you have indicated, it is critical for assurance that the government is acting properly there. One thing I want to ask, the explicit authority is not here, but I just want to make sure for the record that the simultaneous closed-circuit television transmission does not allow the recording of that event, or just the witnessing of it. It's not in here, but I want to make sure it's clear that anytime you involve with closed circuit television, you know, there is the possibility for recording, and that is strictly prohibited. And it's strictly for witnessing, not for
Chairman,
preservation.
Senator Metzger, that is the intent. It's just closed circuit, and that would be a live feed, and the live feed means just that. It's not recorded.
And if I may, Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, that was a concern that we had. It was very evident in the discussions we had that there was no intent by any of the parties, especially the Department of Corrections, to allow the taping.
So make sure this is not permissive, does not allow them to do that.
Mr. Chair, Senator Minnis, if I could add also, the rules that the department has prohibits the media representatives from bringing any equipment, even their own, in with them. And in fact, they're issued paper and pencil when they go in, and that's the only recording equipment that they have.
And just to complete the circle, Chairman, Senator Metzger, and it was not the intent of any of the parties sitting around the table to seek that, and do not seek that.
Let's make it clear that the legislative intent
right.
is that this is not to be recorded just because it is transmitted.
That's correct.
All right, Senator Cordy.
I don't see where it's here in the bill as amended, or even I don't know your administrative rules. The media is now allowed in as it is, at least members of the Statesman Journal were there at the last couple of executions. I'm curious to know, you are protecting the identity of the employees in the institutions. I noticed there's language in here and that the individual who administers the lethal injection shall not be considered to be in the practice of medicine as per Oregon statute.
is the identity of the physician, I assume it's a physician, maybe it isn't, but is that kept so that you can't see the individual and you don't know who it is? Because I assume that's a volunteer. It's not an employee.
Chairman and Senator Courtney, that would continue to be a person that we would attempt to protect their identity. They would move in prior to the execution. They would just see the top of their head. They could have a hat on to conceal their identity, and then they would not come back in until the curtains were closed or drawn. And again, they would just see the top of the person, who would then ensure that that person was... the order was carried out as far as the execution goes, and it was pronounced the death.
Mr. Chair, Senator Courtney, if I may make one clarification, I see kind of puzzled a little bit. We went actually through with the Department of Corrections and some of the employees, the Association of Oregon Corrections Employees, went through an exercise of how to actually place the camera and whether the camera could be placed in an above position that showed the entire table that would not then allow the identity of the participants to be shown. Obviously, if you show it from the side view, that was a concern we had, as you can see face, you can see height, so forth. If, however, you do the filming from above, then with a hat, you don't have the ability to able identify those individuals that are participating in that exercise. And they actually did a filming from three different angles to decide whether or not it could be done to the satisfaction of all the participants at this table, including the employees, and still not give away identities, but have allow the press the full view of the procedure in itself. So in answer to your question about the position, we're viewing from above. Corrections officer, same thing. All the views are from above.
And the control of that whole issue, and I assume, is the amended language on page 2, line 3, where it says that the superintendent may require the persons who are present at the execution under subsection 1, section, view the initial execution procedures prior to the point of the administration of legal by means of a simultaneous. I mean, it's that language that allows them to control the circumstances under which the viewing occurs. Because, I mean, it doesn't say that the camera angle will be X or Y or whatever else. But.
Chairman Menes, member of the committee, that's the reason for that, to ensure that we can protect the identity of those people involved.
And the public policy that we're implementing here is that by having the media there officially in statute, the public is there?
Chairman Menes, Senator Courtney, it's the decision of even the department is to have the media involved to report the event, because it's an event that people want to know about. What goes on behind the walls of that institution where the execution would be carried out today, and we invite them to be part of that execution.
All right. The Oregon newspaper publishers are there. They're
Chairman Menes.
Okay, broadcasters.
Yeah.
Newspapers.
They were. Yes, there you are.
And you're all happy with this language, right? Mm-hmm. Everybody's happy with the intent.
Yes.
Everybody's happy with the direction. No more silly little lawsuits? Okay. Okay. All right.
Well, Mr. Chair, were you asking us if we were happy?
No.
Oh, okay.
But I'm expecting to hear from you.
I'll wait in the work session this week.
Not yet.
Yeah.
That came out of the rules.
That's right.
I'm not sure.
Okay. Work session.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Duncan.
Yeah, I'm happy that they've worked it all out. And that, you know, everybody's so agreeable, and I will vote for this, but I just wish we weren't having to do this sort of thing. I really am opposed to the capital punishment idea, and it's just kind of a macabre kind of a situation to be involved in. But I will vote aye, because I think it does. I was bothered by the one response, though, that we had about for the people of Oregon or something. And I know people like to hear all this stuff, and I understand the press wanting to be there, but I guess it's just I frankly, I'd just say, go do the thing, get it over if we're going to have to do it, but not make a big show of it.
Well, and I think the real issue here is a constitutional issue.
I understand.
First Amendment, free press, the ability of the press to have access to report exactly the issues that the state is engaged in, and that's the execution of individual...
That's well, but yes, but, yeah. You know, I just don't like it.
All right. Did you move the bill?
What?
Did you move the bill? I just don't.
No, I didn't.
Who wants to move the bill? Anybody want to move the bill?
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill, which I've already put aside, 2096 to the floor of the due pass.
All right. Senator Metzger moves House Bill 2096, unamended, to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Any discussion?
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
I do think that obviously the time is not now, and my moment to discuss it has come and gone, but I think the issue of how public an execution should be is an issue and a discussion that maybe some legislative session will get into, because it is an issue that deserves very, needs a, I mean, if we're going to execute, have the death penalty, I do think that is an issue. And I realize we've discussed it, obviously, to a certain extent, to get to where it is today, the witnesses, the relatives, and now putting in here the media. But I think a general discussion, an overall discussion needs to be had of that subject, as painful as it may be, maybe even in the interim, of how public an execution should be given, but it's happening with the death penalty across the nation. As you know, the McVeigh thing is, that's what's being talked about more than anything else, not the actual execution, but who's going to be there, how public should it be, courts are being handed in judgment. So for what it's worth, this, you know, it's not the time the bill needs to go, but I do think it is a topic that, or a subject that some legislative session or anyone would do well to decide to discuss at length and investigate and look into and research.
Okay. Senator Metzger.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. And I appreciate the comments of the Senator from the Capitol, because I think in this, and you're absolutely right, Senator Courtney, I think the discussion in terms of how broad that participation in this event, and we certainly heard a lot now, and all we hear every day on the radio is about Timothy McVeigh and different issues coming up with that. However, this bill deals with an issue that is critical, and that is, and I think it was pointed out by the witnesses, is that when the state executes its most awesome power, which is the execution of an individual, that the public needs to be assured of the fact that the state is not going beyond its bounds. And short of, you know, inviting the citizens of that state to see that the state is operating properly within the orders of its constitution, having representatives of the media there who are that fourth estate, the extension of that, provides some comfort that the state is not overstepping that bounds. And I would be the first one to say that if we went to that over that line, you know, that's why I say about recording or other things in which you are not witnessing the power of the state, but using it for other purposes, I would strongly object. But having that fourth estate there to see that the state is not overstepping its citizenry is a responsibility we have. It limits it to those individuals, and then they have a tremendous responsibility to make sure and to convey whether one agrees or disagrees with the death penalty, to be able to convey to the citizens of the state that the state has operated within the constitutional bounds that has been given by its citizens. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. For the discussion, Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. President. I'm really supporting this in the spirit that Senator Metzger just articulated. And I think people also need to be aware that this is an awesome responsibility for the reporters involved who actually witness these executions. When I worked for the AP in this building back in the 70s, I worked with a longtime AP veteran, Paul Harvey, who went through several executions, and you could tell by talking to him that it was an incredibly difficult and excruciating experience for him, and I think it probably got reflected in his coverage. So it's, you know, we're not just doing something lightly here. I was always kind of counting my blessings that I got through my tenure with AP without ever having been sent to one of these. Had I been sent, I would have certainly done my duty, but always considered myself fortunate that I didn't have to go through that. So I think we need to understand that when the press does this, they are truly performing their watchdog function in our society for the benefit of all the citizens in a way that often takes a tremendous personal toll on them.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Duncan.
You know, I think there's another element we need to remember that I've heard that we're talking about the personal toll it does take. And I think we must remember the corrections officials themselves, because I understand there's nothing more traumatic in a prison setting than the preparation for an execution during that particular time. It's just a very traumatic time for those people, too, and I recognize that.
All right. I won't go into my horror stories, but I have strong sympathies for the victims of crimes and the families of the victims of crimes. And I oftentimes wish that the media could see what police officers see in the United States. And just in the 25 years I've been in law enforcement, to see the traumatic incidents and clean up some of the messes that some of these folks that we have so much sympathy for at the time of execution have imposed on other people's lives. So there's a balance in all of this. There's a tremendous balance. Mm-hmm. And I've been with police officers who've been to scenes of crimes who are crying their eyes out because they can't deal with what they're seeing and the horrors that are inflicted by individuals. So there is balance, and I hope the media, you know, in their responsibilities, they report both of those things, because the central element of all of this is justice. And justice is never necessarily easy, and sometimes it's right. And there's never, in my opinion, honor in taking anybody's life, ever, whether it's taken by the hand of a police officer or in war or in an execution.
Mr. Chair?
Yes, sir.
May I just clarify one thing? In my comments, at no point have I had any sympathy for the perpetrator.
I understand. All right. Further discussion? If not, any objections? Hearing none, so ordered. And I think I will carry this on the floor. All right. Hopefully we have a few lighthearted topics here today.
That's a tough one.
All right. 2663, public hearing, Representative Tootie Smith. Representative Tootie Smith, the bill. The bill number is 2663. Representative, thank you for coming over.
You're welcome.
And it looks like it's your responsibility to tell us what this bill does.
Oh, I guess so. I'm Representative Tootie Smith from House District 28. Thank you for listening to me today. I'm one of the co-sponsors of this bill, House Bill 2663. And what this bill does, it extends the statute of limitations for rape and sodomy in the first and second degrees only when there is DNA evidence implicating the defendant. Under current law, the statute of limitations for first and second degree rape or sodomy is only 6 years. This bill increases the statute of limitations to 12. With advances in DNA technology and other forms of criminal investigation methods, our law enforcement agencies are able to revisit crimes and determine the guilt of the perpetrators with a much higher degree of accuracy. Every tool available to victims and prosecutors must be made available in order to bring these offenders to justice. Technology has continued to increase our ability to track down criminals and match repeat or serial offenders to other victims. However, statute of limitations are preventing many offenders from being prosecuted. This bill mainly targets the most dangerous criminals, serial rapists. This passed off the House floor 56, aye, zero noes, and four excused.
Right, and I assume the intent is that where you have bona fide evidence from DNA.
I beg your pardon, sir.
Let's saying that where you have DNA evidence, that's bona fide evidence.
Yes, that's bona fide evidence, yes. I think this statute will, in a way, try to catch us up with current technology that's available.
All right. All right. Any questions? Senator Hartman? Where does 12 come from?
I beg your pardon, I can't.
The number 12. Why 12 years?
I really don't know.
Okay. I don't know either, but I can render a guess.
Mr. Chairman, members, I think it was originally 20 on the House side, so it was, I think that was taken down to 12 because of the decisions of the members.
And 12 happens to also be the number that is what's called the statute of ultimate repose in civil cases, which basically is the time at which everything stops. I mean, the time tolls, you can't go back and do anything.
There's nothing to do with the quality of the evidence. DNA does not go bad over time. They just pick the number.
So I think you could go back further if you wanted to, if you had legitimate evidence that had been preserved. But maybe also just to put a limit on, you know, how many people might be subjected to this particular law. And we're going to hear from Ingrid in a moment here.
Okay.
Thank you, Rick. For the
and thank you for listening.
Appreciate it. Thank you. Ingrid, your turn.
Good afternoon, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. Ingrid Swenson, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. We are opposed to the extension of the statute of limitations under these circumstances, and basically because the purpose of a statute of limitations is to recognize that after the passage of a certain period of time, it may be close to impossible to pull together the evidence and witnesses that would be necessary for either side in the case. Even though this bill is limited to circumstances in which DNA is involved, and in some cases DNA can be definitive evidence, it's not addressed to just those cases where that's the only missing element. So you can easily imagine a circumstance where a defendant is identified as a result of DNA testing after the passage of 6 years and before the passage of 12 years. But it may not be definitive in that case. Supposing, for example, that there were multiple people involved in an offense, including the defendant who was present, and it's the participation of the defendant which is at issue in the case, whether he was physically involved, whether there was consent on behalf of some person and perhaps not on behalf of the other, the defendant is in an extreme disadvantage because you have this one piece of evidence which the jury will tend to be influenced by, and yet the defendant may be completely unable to reconstruct what he needs to in order to have his witnesses present who could have exonerated him. So the purpose of the statute of limitations is to say it's reasonable to wait a period of 6 years and then assume that people can try to put together their evidence, their defense, find their witnesses, and so forth. But the longer you extend that, the less likely it is that that person will be able to produce those witnesses and the evidence that might be necessary to exonerate him.
Well, you know, I do sex crimes investigations in my other life, and I'm trying to think of an application where this would apply. And I'm thinking that would be a case where you have a woman, or could be a man, who's claiming that they have been raped, but they can't identify a suspect. It's a stranger-to-stranger incident. They cannot identify the person, but they can articulate the factual circumstances that obviously led them to believe that they were. They would have gone to a hospital, had a rape kit done, you know, swabs of the various parts of the body, and then there would have been that evidence preserved. So the evidence in question is the identity of the perpetrator, which would be connected through the DNA evidence. So what your argument then is what? I'm not sure. So let's say we identify the person whose semen is in the vagina or the anus of this individual.
Mr. Chief.
And then the prosecution decides, well, we're going to go to trial because the victim still wants to go. It's within this new statute of limitation. Where's the defendant that you're now representing disadvantaged again?
Mr. Chair, take for example, say a prostitute is raped, and say on the same day that she is raped, she has consensual sex with someone else, whom she doesn't necessarily know. And semen is found, and it's saved, and ultimately the person with whom she had consensual sex is identified by DNA through some other connection, and this person could have enough of a memory of this individual to say, oh, I remember him, that is the person who raped me. And it may be that there were witnesses and people who knew at the time that this was a consensual act with respect to this person, although she was in fact raped by someone else. But the defendant is at an extreme disadvantage after 12 years in terms of producing information and evidence to assist in his defense.
Okay, so a prostitute who may have had consensual sex mm-hmm. with one of her clients or whatever.
Or anyone.
Give me another example. I'm trying to...
It could be some individual who had sex with someone consensually without respect to prostitution was then raped.
That's one of the normal questions that we ask in those investigations is, have you had consensual sex with anyone else? And that's part of the rape kit form. That's what we ask.
Mr. Chair, I understand, and yet the rape kit might well have more than one sample.
Well, but that's the whole point. If I'm talking to a person who's alleging that they've been raped, and I say, have you had consensual sex with anyone else? mm-hmm. And they say, yes, I had consensual sex with my husband, boyfriend, whomever.
Mm-hmm.
I've got a name, I've got identification, I know who that person is. Now, I don't necessarily have to follow through and get DNA from that person, but if we subsequently get DNA evidence that is available, mm-hmm. my next step as an investigator is to go back to that individual she said she had sexual intercourse with, consensual sex with, get a swab from that person, submit it to the lab for comparison, and voila.
I understand, Mr. Chair, but I'm just saying that there's certainly at least a possibility that DNA evidence will, quote, identify the defendant, but will not be definitive and puts the defendant at the disadvantage.
That's the reason we have a trial, right?
Well, a trial can be useful if you have evidence, but after 12 years, how are you going to be able to find the people that you need to find? If there were built into this statute the ability of a court to say, under the circumstances of this case, too much time has passed, despite the fact that the statute has not run, to allow the defendant the opportunity to present a defense, you know, I think that would help. But I do think there is a significant problem presented for potentially innocent defendants who are identified and cannot present the defense that they could have presented had it been brought earlier.
Okay, don't we have a similar circumstance, though, with the statute of limitations for child sexual abuse?
We do.
And the same arguments you would make, I assume, with that particular extension of statute of limitations, which is current law.
Mr. Chair, that's correct. But there are compelling reasons with respect to young children who can't or who were unable at the time of the offense to identify someone or to even acknowledge that the act had occurred. And so the legislature chose in that instance to balance the interests of those child victims against the defendant's right to a fair trial. And I might not agree with where that balance is, but I don't think that's what we're looking at here.
Okay, thank you.
Mr. Chair, can I ask a
question? Yes,
Craig. Mr. Chairman and Ingrid, one of the things that concerns me about the way this is written, you and the Chair have mentioned the way that the time is calculated for a minor victim, which is the statute runs at the age of when the victim is 24, that's the time frame if the victim is under 18. Now, I can see if the victim of the crime was, say, 6 years old, and that you would have 18 years in which to bring that. This, as it's amended, I think would limit that and says within 12 years of the commit of the crime. And I wonder if that's something that's been brought up in the House. I'd be interested in that because I'm unclear if the intent of this measure is to have that that calculated that way, because I don't think that this amendment takes into account that,
so
that point.
Are you suggesting then that this particular bill may have a conflict with an existing statute where you have DNA evidence?
No, Mr. Chairman, what I'm saying is it looks to me that on lines 42 through 45, it makes a bright line rule that it must, that the prosecution must be commenced within 12 years of the commission of the crime. And as you pointed out, for a victim, a minor victim, the statute we currently have can be longer than 12 years, because if the victim is 6 years old, it could run until 24.
That's what I'm saying.
Yeah.
And that statute needs to be referenced.
Somehow we need, or if the, I was unclear if that was the intent, to make a bright line rule to say,
yeah,
this only applies within 12 years. I'm sure Representative Winters, looks like she's got an answer. Okay. That was one concern I wanted to raise.
All right. We do need it. We'll have to work out that potential conflict, because it could set up two conflicting statutes.
Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Ingrid, in regard to the points you made about the delay in time and witnesses, but does it not remain the responsibility of the state to prove the guilt of the individual? So this erosion of memory and witnesses would, since the burden is on the state, would seem to have, everything else being equal, a greater burden on the state than the defendant, wouldn't it?
Mr. Chair and Senator Metzger, again, the state decides when to bring a prosecution, and so, of course, they would look at all their evidence and decide whether, based on that, they had enough to go forward. Unfortunately for the defendant, whenever they are arrested or charged, that's when they have to respond, and they can undertake to do an investigation and to try and provide to the jury witnesses who will corroborate the defendant's statement. But yes, the state must prove these charges, and even though there's DNA evidence, you can certainly argue to the jury that all this does is say that this semen was found under these circumstances. But I have to say that in the defense of that kind of prosecution, DNA evidence is powerful, and it would be easy for a jury to assume, well, why wouldn't he say that it was consensual and there must have been some other problem here, and why doesn't he have something more to tell us about that? And I suppose you could present an investigator who said, I tried very hard to find John Doe, but he's been gone for 10 years or now. So I think it significantly disadvantages the defendant, even though the burden remains on the state.
The other thing, Mr. Chair, if I could continue, on a different subject matter with this, the discussion has been about the identification of semen DNA, but this bill does not say that, and I was it just talks about DNA. So I'm thinking about maybe kind of shifting to your side, Ingrid, on this. What about the situation in which, let me give you your thoughts on this, in which you had a rape situation, and among DNA was things found at the scene of the purported crime, which they took DNA samples. You know, a handkerchief was left. They took a DNA sample off this, or a glove. And 12 years later or whatever, the DNA on a piece of evidence, it wasn't through penetration of the individual. It was something else was identified. And then I think maybe your arguments might be stronger, because if someone could have been at a scene and not been a perpetrator but been DNA evidence at, I was wondering if that issue had been discussed in the House of other types of DNA evidence as opposed to simply, you know, sexual penetration.
Mr. Chair and Senator Metzger, I don't know if it was discussed in the House, but you're quite right. The farther you get from evidence that kind of has to be of the nature required to obtain a conviction, the more difficult it is to deal with that evidence years after the fact and explain why it might have been there. But I think you're correct. That's a good example of the problem you would encounter, because this just requires that the defendant be identified, not as, you know, not in connection with any particular kind of evidence.
And I think if you recall on some of the previous discussions that we've had about some of the DNA, we've had Senate Bill 667, Dale Penn was here, we talked about where you have certain DNA evidence that, in this case, wouldn't be something that was extracted from the body of the victim, but was other evidence that is has to fit into the factual context of the circumstances of that case. Would have to be argued by the prosecutor and taken into consideration, I assume, before the prosecutor would even take the case up. Another instance that I think would, coming from my investigative background, if I had a 12-year-old case that we suddenly came up with additional DNA, I would have to go back and look at that 12-year-old case, and this is before I'd be able to submit it to the district attorney, go back and look at the case, start looking at the witnesses, seeing if the witnesses are still available, probably re-interviewing those people again so that I've got, you know, maybe a fresh interview, verifying that they're in place, and then resubmitting that case to the district attorney's office. And then the district attorney would make a judgment as to whether or not they feel it's a prosecutable case, something that they feel they can prove beyond a reasonable doubt. Then Ingrid's folks would have to get involved in terms of defending that particular person. Other questions? Have we gotten a hold of Virginia? She's going to come up, try to get Virginia to explain to us whether we have a conflict or not in terms of how this is drafted. Jackie, did you want to come up and, excuse me, Representative Winters?
Thank you, Chair Minnis and members of the committee. For the record, I'm Jackie Winters, State Representative for District 31. You've had a lot of discussion about House Bill 2663. I'm not going to go over some of the discussions that you've had, but I would like to read some excerpts from a letter that I received to put in context this issue of why going beyond the six-year limitation. And it says, a few weeks ago, on April 1st, 2001, my daughter and I spent a difficult day together marking the sixth year passing an assault, which seems to never cease in pain in her recollection. On that day, 6 years ago, she was abducted at gunpoint, held and sexually assaulted for 6 hours until she successfully talked her attacker out of killing her and himself and releasing her. She was 16 years old at the time. A tremendous amount of evidence was gathered at that time. The attacker left behind viable DNA in a condom and a good description of the man. The car he held her in, the gun he used were well documented. Despite no one was ever identified, and my daughter was left only with the hope that one day the man might be identified through DNA checks in the future. For the last several years, my daughter has agonized over the date which has now arrived and passed, the day when the statute of limitation has run out and gone, with any hope she will ever face her attacker and see him come to justice. As you likely are aware, 17 previously unsolved crimes were solved this year in Oregon on the basis of DNA evidence. What a shame. The statute of limitation does not take into account the compelling scientific method to provide evidence that can prove beyond a shadow of a doubt and bring to justice a person who may have robbed a child or a woman of a strong and peaceful mental and emotional life. Memories of faces and places may fade beyond usefulness to stand in a court of law, but haunting memories live on. I understand that there is conversation around the idea of reducing the proposed limitation from 20 down to 12. I do not know why this would make sense, and I'm interested in understanding what the benefit might be by not leaving the bill at 20 years. But I do understand that I and my daughter do need some justice.
All right. Thank you, Senator Harper.
How do we get to 12?
The 12 was after some discussion with Representative Vicki Walker, who has also had an experience, and in talking about the length of time of remembering some of those other issues, and in some negotiation with her, we arrived on the 12 in a bipartisanship fashion.
back to 20, would you be mad at us?
No, I would not.
Senator Brink, any comment? No comment, okay. Thank you.
Your
appreciate
pleasure.
It. We're kind of waiting for Virginia, and here she comes. Hi, Virginia.
Here she comes.
Yeah, yeah, we're just, hopefully Craig kind of clued you in as to what the concern was.
Mr. Chairman, Ms. Vanderbilt, what I had brought up to the committee was that I think when this bill was amended on the House side, as originally drafted it took into account the fact that for a minor victim, really you have until that victim attains the age of 24 as a statute of limitations in some cases, and that when this bill was amended on the House, that portion was taken out, so that I read this as saying that DNA evidence rule that they were trying to create here, you can only revive that case within 12 years of the crime, and it does not encompass that issue of a minor victim coming forward by 24.
Chairman and members of the committee, I'm Virginia Vanderbilt, Legislative Counsel's Office. I think that's correct. I don't know. I say this as if I'm not the one who did this, and of course I am the one who did this, so I should know how it happened. For some reason, between the introduced bill where we had the piece about the minor victim and the -1 amendments and then finally the -4 amendments, which were engrossed into the bill, you know, so that it's the A engrossed version you have, for some reason we deleted the provision that dealt with the minor victim and then whichever occurs later language, which I think addresses the concern that you, that the committee has been expressing.
Okay, so Virginia, the language on line 42, page 2, where it says notwithstanding subsection 2 of this section,
mm-hmm.
that doesn't get us there?
You know, I'm sure I thought it did when I drafted it. When the first set of amendments had a 20-year limit, and I don't know if the thought process was is that 20 years was so long that that would pretty much take you to the time most people were going to be 24. I honestly can't remember what the thought process was. But clearly with the 12-year period, it certainly does not get you to the same place, I don't think. So I think we need to reinsert language that's similar to what we had in the introduced bill, which says it may be commenced within 12 years, or if the victim at the time of the crime was under 18, you know, any time before the victim attains 24 years of age, whichever occurs later.
Right.
If that's, you know, the direction the committee wants to go. I think that would clear up any ambiguity.
All right. And Representative, sorry, Senator.
I'm just trying to remember the. Excuse me.
That's okay. You go ahead.
The letter that Representative Winters read, if I recall, I thought the girl was 16 and the 6 years were up that particular time. Didn't she have 2 more years to go then, really?
It's possible, but not knowing, because if you read the statute as it is now, if she had reported it to law enforcement or another government agency, then the time starts tolling at that point, and the 6-year statute of limitations kicks in, which another government agency can be a school, can be a counselor in a school, whatever, and for any number of reasons, the prosecution may not have occurred, so statute of limitations is still tolling, and that's part of the problem, is that there's an assumption that once the person discloses to somebody who's a government official or law enforcement, that starts that 6-year statute of limitations, and assumedly something's going to happen. So.
Okay, that's why I was having a couple of calculators.
Right. Okay. So you want to bring us back some amendments at all?
Well, when would you like me to bring those back?
Oh, I don't know, 10, 15 minutes? No. I'm just kidding. Senator Metzger. Just one point. Virginia, in trying to unify those two sections, mm-hmm. the only thing I just noticed is that under the current language, it does deal, the time frame is set at the time it's reported to a government agency. The new amendment is 12 years from the commission of the offense. Just wanted to make sure that whatever we do in amendment, that's consistent so that there's another problem there.
And again, I'm going to suggest that probably what we're trying to get to here is where the crime has been reported. because it can be very difficult for law enforcement to go back and pick up any DNA evidence that occurred.
Right.
That they didn't investigate.
Yeah.
The assumption is they reported it.
Mm-hmm. Right.
But it was not prosecutable because the suspect's identity was not known.
Right. And Chair Minnis, I mean, that is certainly the direction that the amendments were trying to go. And it, the language, if, you know, if the defendant is identified after the, you know, the period, I mean, the thought was is that the crime has been reported, the evidence has been collected.
Right.
And then the identity becomes known at some later date.
And in fact, I mean, we still have legal hurdles because the evidence that would have been collected would have had to have been retained in a manner in which it was not corrupted, which is another legal issue that could be attacked at a later point. So, okay, where are we on the 20 versus 12-year issue?
So moved.
Yep.
Senator Burdick.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I just wanted to express a discomfort with the bill as it's written now, but I would be, you know, when we talk about people under 18, I could certainly support something that would say, you know, maybe 12 years after the crime is reported or 24 years old, whichever one comes later. I would feel comfortable with that with minors, but I don't feel comfortable with the broad reach of this bill in all circumstances because of the points that Ingrid Swenson raised about being able to put on a defense. I feel that there are reasons, very compelling reasons, to kind of go the extra mile for people who are minors when they're the victims of crimes like this, but I'm nervous about extending it too broadly. So that's just my comment.
Okay. Well, and that's instructive. Dale Penn just wandered in, so we might drag him up here too. But maybe not. I don't know. He just grimaced. But I think the whole issue, and if it may give you some comfort, is, again, it's a factual circumstance. The prosecutor, ultimately, who makes the decision to take this to trial, is going to have to prove it in trial. And anytime you have old evidence, I think that argument's a pretty substantial threshold for prosecutors to argue, whether it's a homicide trial or whether it's a rape trial. So, you want to share your views on this? I mean, we've kind of been all
sure.
over the map on this thing.
Mr. Chairman, my name is Dale Penn. I'm Marion County District Attorney. I apologize for being late. I did intend to be here to testify on this bill. I do support the bill testified on the House side. I support it as a 20-year statute of limitations, and the reason is that we do have all these proof problems the chair was just mentioning and any kind of extended statute of limitations, and really this is a unique scenario because what we're talking about is the type of case where it's a stranger and stranger situation, rape or sodomy. The victim does not know the offender, and this is the typical kind of case where the person wearing a mask breaking into a house. It's not a party situation where you know who is at the party and it's acquaintances and those kinds of things. Those cases would be investigated at the time. But this is a scenario where we have no idea who did this. This is a stranger. And yet, in this unique situation, we have physical evidence that establishes by itself who was there committing this sexual act, whether it's 10 years ago or 15 years ago or 20 years ago. That is the uniqueness in this scenario, and that's why it's been restricted to rape and sodomy cases and restricted to situations where there are DNA physical evidence available. So with those limiters there, I think we get away from the situation of, gee, how could I defend myself from what I was doing 15 years ago? With this type of evidence, there is no question. You remember Professor Winner, the biology professor, talking about the certainty of DNA evidence. There is no question what this individual was doing 20 years ago at this moment. We know he was having sex with this person, and when we were able to develop physical evidence of DNA from that sexual act. So it is very limited, and that's why we supported the 20-year extension.
And I think Representative Winters, I've heard her testimony before, many states are analyzing this now and going with no statute of limitations in these kinds of cases because of the certainty of this physical evidence alone. But that's why we support it.
Senator Metzger. Thank you, Mr. Chair. Dale, you weren't here earlier, so I'll ask you this question. In terms of your comfort zone, in terms of limiting the bill, again, you're talking about DNA evidence that has been established of had sexual intercourse with an individual, and yet the bill does not is not limited to DNA relating to semen or the act of sexual intercourse. It just says DNA.
Yeah.
So I mean, you know, people could have gloves. They dropped a handkerchief or other things, and once you had DNA evidence that might be used to show someone was possibly there or maybe not there because, you know, DNA is accumulative, but it could be used to bring somebody up on charges, but not the original intent of the bill, which is that they actually had sexual intercourse. That's one concern I had.
Mr. Chair and Senator Metzger, I agree with that. That we've tried to limit it as much as we can, and that's where I think the chair's comments about the practicalities come into play. And it's similar to the situation we discussed with Senate Bill 667 on the request for the new trial. There are some sections or pieces of evidence of DNA. They really don't prove anything. Now, I am a prosecutor. I have a case 19 years ago. I know that this individual was raped at gunpoint with a man with a mask. She has no idea who this person was. I have no physical evidence. But I do have a hair on a piece of clothing, and it's DNA. That's the only piece of evidence I have. I don't have any capability to prove beyond a reasonable doubt that this individual with a hair on an outside piece of clothing, that's not going to prove anything. However, if the DNA evidence that I do have is from a body sample of bodily fluid, then I have a case. And that's where the practicalities come into play. But it's difficult to limit it much more than DNA evidence, but that's got to be very pertinent DNA evidence to really have a prosecutable case.
I want to correct one thing that you said earlier, too, because I don't think you intended to say it, but you indicated that this person doesn't know the suspect. Because it's possible that they do not know who the perpetrator of the crime was, but that once that DNA evidence identifies a suspect, they in fact may very well have known that person or have met that person, because research in
Absolutely.
Sex crimes indicates that in about, I think it's about 85% or 90% of these cases,
yes.
The victim has met the suspect.
Absolutely, Mr. Chair, and I meant that the victim could not say, this is the person who raped me. They may be acquainted, but by disguise or whatever, they can't give the police a name. If they had a name, then the police are going to be interviewing, they're going to be working that case. This is really, this old of a case, it's really going to come up only where here is now physical scientific evidence that can establish this by itself.
Mr. Penn, I was wondering, Ingrid raised some points about the defendant's rights. Had you thought, when you testified about this, about the defendant's right to a speedy trial in these kind of cases and how that's calculated, if you could talk to the committee about that?
Well, normally, Mr. Chair and counsel, normally right to speedy trial attaches when there is a charge filed. And so we have this kind of scenario where there is no capability to file a charge until we may have the DNA sample from the victim, but we didn't get the sample from the defendant until last week because he just got arrested and convicted in some other place, and now his DNA sample has hit the pool. Now, that is not to say that that's the typical situation of the speedy trial right begins once the charge is filed. Now, constitutionally, we will have defendants raise the issue this is too long of a delay. But in that type of scenario, we have certainly had murder cases. I prosecuted a murder case that was 20 years old when we prosecuted it. because we didn't know until someone started making some statements 18 years after the crime. That's when we were able to develop evidence, initiate the charge, and prosecute and convict someone. I have never seen in these elongated statute of limitations a constitutional claim upheld by the court saying that this is a denial of speedy trial constitutionally or a denial of speedy charging constitutionally, where the fact is that the investigation was not at a point where it could charge someone until this later point. So I don't see that as a problem. Other states, as I said, in this kind of scenario, some of them have said no statute of limitations, just like murder. So.
All right. Thank you very much. Virginia, thank you. And I think what we're going to do is we'll get that adjusting language for the minor versus adult issue thing going. But we'll bring it back in two forms, one with a 12-year, one with a 20-year, and at that point we'll have the committee decide which way they want to go, if any. Thank you, Virginia. Appreciate you coming up. All righty. So we'll close the public hearing then on House Bill 2663. And... do we have a favorite bill we want to hit on here?
Unlimited.
Well, let's start at the top of the list now that we've been all over the map. 29th public hearing. Who's my victim?
Yes, I am, Mr. Chair.
You did an excellent job.
Is that concerned?
Nick, you're back.
Chair, member of the committee, I'm Nick Armenicus, Oregon Department of Corrections, and I'm here to provide information and support for HB 2094A Gross, which introduced at the request of the Department of Corrections. From time to time, county sheriffs and other local government officials have asked the department to commit our personnel and resources to assist them in responding in events of a security or other emergencies at county jails, or in providing health care or treatment services for inmates confined in local jails and juvenile detention facilities. However, the statutes that create and establish the department's duties and powers do not authorize the department generally to exercise custody or provide service to county jail inmates or youths confined in county juvenile facilities. With this bill, the Oregon Department of Corrections requests express authority to enter into arrangements and agreements, contract with local governments to assist local governments by providing security assistance, technical assistance, health care services, training assistance, transport service, and treatment services with requests from local governments or correctional facilities at that request. This bill does not require the department to provide services to assist local governments. This does not grant clear authority to the department to do so when it is in the best interest of the department or local government to be partners. That concludes my hearing, my testimony.
All right. Thank you, sir. Russ, questions, comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. Russ Spencer for the sheriffs. We are obviously very much in support of this bill. It is the result of conversations that several of our sheriffs have had with Director Cook and other staff members at the Department of Corrections. The types of situations where we envision the utilization of these kinds of agreements are probably most primarily in eastern Oregon and other rural areas in the state, where we're talking about being able to take advantage of economies of scale provided by the Department of Corrections in terms of health care, treatment, and so forth, and also particularly in the area of security operations, specifically cell extractions. As I'm sure the chair and committee members appreciate, management control of inmates in a correctional institution is both an art and a science. And the Department of Corrections has a number of highly trained, very capable cell extraction teams that can provide a safe and effective way of removing an inmate who is not willing to come out of their cell for whatever reason in a safe and efficient manner. And their training and expertise exceeds the capabilities that many local jurisdictions have to be able to train their officers to that level. So this would allow us to be able to request assistance from the Department of Corrections for situations such as that.
All right. Senator Cordy.
Thank you.
Does this work both ways?
Mr. Chairman, Senator Courtney, I'm certain that we would respond to any request for assistance that the Department of Corrections would ever issue to us. However, the Department of Corrections requires statutory authorization in order to be able to assist us. We do not require statutory authorization in order to assist them. So, yes and no, I guess. I can't envision a circumstance where the Department of Corrections would seek assistance that we wouldn't help.
Chair, Senator Courtney, today the local authorities assist us in emergencies when we need them to assist us in perimeter control. We need to house an inmate temporarily from INS detainers. We'll use county facilities. So we have an agreement, but our concern today is that if we have a state employee handle a inmate who's under county control or other local control, we are not covered under liability-wise.
Okay, I understand the view of what you're trying to do in that bill. It's a good bill. I just wanted to know if we needed a bill to perhaps go the other way, given I live in Marion County where there's a lot of correctional facilities. And could I ask, Mr. Chair, what you used the phrase, Mr. Spence, cell extraction? No, I won't even tell you what I thought that meant. But would you, for the record, tell me what you meant when you used the phrase cell extraction?
Yes, Mr. Chairman, Senator Courtney, it has nothing to do with DNA. From time to time, you will have an inmate who will refuse to come out of their cell, maybe for a court appearance, maybe for an administrative hearing, for whatever reason. They may barricade themselves into a cell and can pose a significant threat to corrections officers whose duty it is to go in and get him out of there. Because you are working in extremely confined spaces, and this inmate may have some type of weapon that they've managed to acquire, it's a situation that is extremely volatile and requires a high degree of training and expertise to coordinate actions in a very tense and highly charged situation. And that's what the Department of Corrections has teams that spend a great deal of time and energy and effort training to deal with these crisis situations. And that kind of training is simply something that, due to resources, our local guys just don't have the ability to avail themselves.
At the DPSST?
Mr. Chairman, I defer to the Department of Corrections as to where they train.
Chairman, Senator Courtney, that's normally handled within the Department of Corrections because it is a specialized training, and we have annual qualifications on that particular subject matter.
Mr. Chair? Thank you, sir. Mary, I'm sorry, Senator Metzger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. This is for Mary's Department of Corrections. Obviously, this is a good bill. It provides the cooperation needed. Just want to clarify, where it says the corrections may enter into arrangements, contracts, or agreements for various services, medical care services, and others, is that it would not be the intention or the practice of the Department of Corrections to provide services out of the budget expense of the Department of Corrections for ongoing services or anything in which the Department of Corrections would say, gee, we entered into a lot of agreements and boy, it's costing us a lot of money and we need more state compensation because we didn't enter into those agreements wisely. That these are more cooperative for not ongoing services, but for emergency services, assistance where necessary, and would protect the financial integrity of the Department of Corrections budget as opposed to extending those services to others.
Chairman, Senator Metzger, that's true. We would continue to be good stewards of the Department of Corrections budget and would not use those resources to extend it to the county. Those would be dealing with emergencies or in areas that we have the expertise and the commodities to give that to the counties or even charge them for that if that's the case.
Right. Thank you.
Mr. Chairman, Senator Metzger, Russ Spencer for the sheriffs. Yeah, I do want to be clear that one of the situations that we contemplate utilizing these agreements on is health care services, and that would be a fee-for-service type of deal. We would not anticipate that this would ever cost the state any money. We would pay for the services that we would utilize.
Right.
We would simply take advantage of their economies of scale.
Right. Thank you, Mr. Chair. All right, Senator Courtney.
Just so you know, for those of you who are probably bored to hear this, this is because I've been here too long, but you're going to get rid of me in a few hours. To me, I see this as an extension of House Bill 1145.
Also, it's not an extension of 1149.
which some of the audience might pick up on that. Also, I find it interesting that I beg a certain state agency, everything's going to be anonymous now, to try to help them with their budget. We don't need any more funds. We can do with what we got. It's going to be easy. And here, this wonderful agency is willing to reach out and help their younger brother and sister, not younger, but their additional brother and sister in such a beneficial way, which means they're loaded with money and they were right. We don't have to worry about that particular agency budget. All for this budget, all for this bill.
Jeez, thank you for that.
Being very vague and intentional because of people in the room as well as people outside this room.
I think they know exactly what you're talking about.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Mary Botkin. I'm here today representing the American Federation of State, County, Municipal Employees. I came up here to support the bill, but Senator Courtney has once again convinced me I might have been wrong.
No, he didn't.
I promised the department I would support the bill when I came up here, but actually, I do think this bill makes some sense in rural Oregon, mostly because of the cost of health care and pharmaceuticals and, you know, kind of the associated issues. That, I mean, there is a certain amount of expertise within our prison system that is not available to the rest of the public safety community, and it makes no sense at all to transport folks further than they need to be transported if we have facilities available in the area, and in many cases we do. And so,
cell extraction.
The cell extraction, Mr. Chair, I thought that my esteemed colleague, Mr. Spencer, was quick to say that it had nothing to do with DNA. In some cases, it might have something to do with DNA. But we do have very highly skilled teams of officers who do cell extractions. It is, if you don't know what you're doing, it is an area, it is a duty that can cause very serious injury to both you as an officer and to the inmate. And so having that expertise available to not only our institutions but also to local jails is a good thing.
All
you know,
right.
Mr. Chair, would you...
Work session.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2094, A and Gross to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
All right, Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2094 to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion. No discussion. Any objections? No objections.
Please let me carry this bill.
Senator Courtney.
I want to carry this one.
We'll carry this.
This one I'm going to like.
And let me see. House Bill 2094.
Seven.
Oh, I'm sorry. 2097.
Public hearing. We have a problem. This is going to be fun. The goodbye bill.
If you signed up and you know who you are, come forward.
I can't do that, Al.
I can't. I don't know what you're saying. You can't. What?
This is being functioned up.
We're working in warp speed, so.
That might be a deal. That might be a deal.
Hi.
Scott, this is cute.
Thank you. Go ahead, sir.
Mr. Minutes, I'm Scott Taylor, representing the Department of Corrections. House Bill 2097 authorized the Department of Corrections and the Oregon Youth Authority provide specified ordinary and extraordinary medical treatment services to persons under 18 years of age. The short version of this is that under Measure 11, we are now receiving a number of youth that are under the age of 18, both at the Department of Corrections and the Oregon Youth Authority. Upon advice of our legal counsel, we do not feel that we have the necessarily the express authority identified in statute to deal with the youth. The Department of Corrections, during its formation, it was not envisioned that we would deal with these young folks. And what this bill allows us to do is respond in medical cases primarily, but medical and mental health where we need to provide medical services. And since they are under the age of 18, we cannot contact their parent or guardian at that point when we need to deliver service. This just authorizes us to go ahead and provide the service.
Okie dokie. Discussion. Make any questions? Work session.
I do.
97.
I did have a question.
A work session, Senator Mesker.
And Scott, you may not be the person. Are they here, Claudia, to answer this question I'm about to ask? Mr. Chair, Scott, it says department will provide ordinary medical, dental, psychiatric, psychological, hygienic, or other remedial care for under 18 years of age. And I just wanted, there's been so much discussion over some of the care provided for inmates at the Department of Corrections, including bone marrow transplants and others that were felt to be extraordinary care. And I just wondered, is that covered under ordinary? Would that be considered ordinary medical care if you had those types of extreme medical remedies available? Would that be covered under this as well?
Chairman Senator Metzger, I believe yes. The idea, it also, and I say that because it deals with emergent medical emergencies or life-threatening, are also some of the more immediate ones we want to deal with. So when you talk about bone marrow transports, transplants, and those sorts of things, we'd have to look at the case. I mean, we have a whole medical procedure we go through, analysis of its necessity, the required of it, choices, options. But if it was determined that it was necessary by our medical staff, then this would also fit in that category.
This will be very brief, Mr. Chair. I'm not going to go into detail, but I certainly support the bill. But I do think there's a discussion we haven't had yet as to the level of care provided, inmates in the Oregon Correctional Institution that we can don't provide our own citizens. And, you know, there's been a number of cases about this going through, which are not considered responsibilities of the state, and yet the instances of extreme cases for people within the Department of Corrections. Now, whether that's right or wrong is one issue, but I think we need to hear the debate and how those standards are set with our Department of Corrections when we can't meet health care responsibilities to other citizens of the state. And I think that is a discussion at some point, not now, that we need to have.
Well, it's a great topic, but I think once we put them in jail, we own them. I mean, we're responsible for them in that sense. So.
Yeah. The question is to what level are you know, the state to be responsible for.
Senator Courtney, do you have?
No.
Jenny's smiling.
I know this is off the subject, but Senator Metzger's question made a question. Do prisoners get more services than are applied on the priority, that are available on the priority list of the Oregon Health Plan? Do they go farther down the priority list?
Chairman, Senator Burdick, it really depends on, as was said, part of our issue is we have court cases that require us to provide service, and so some of the services we review are different than what the Oregon Health Plan might or might not go to. I see my legal counsel.
He's here to help you. And to keep
now, join me.
Yeah, shut up.
Until
I
get there.
I know. We're not going to belabor this point too long.
Chairman, Senator Burdick, members of the committee, for the record, my name is Jeff Van Valkenburg. I'm general counsel for the Department of Corrections. The Oregon Health Plan sets, as you know, an arbitrary amount of care, and there's a very distinct difference in law about the protection that inmates have, both at the state and local level. So it is not the case that the Department of Corrections can tie its provision of care to the health plan priorities and the way that they rationalize the limited dollars that are in that system. We have constitutional responsibilities under the state and federal constitutions to provide care that is treating without deliberate indifference the serious medical needs of local and state inmates. And that can require us to do things that frankly, we decide as a society not to provide for poor people.
Okay. Thank you, Jeff. Appreciate it.
Thank you for the time.
Blowing it up there.
Another time.
Yeah,
Mr. All right. We're in work session.
Mr. Chair, I move House Bill 2097 to the floor of the due pass recommendation.
All right. Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2097 unamended to the floor of the Senate with a due pass recommendation.
Jail.
Mr. Chair, session, sir.
Can I ask a question? I have, this is very small print and it violates the ADA, but in my copy, it reads, I just want to, at the request of Governor John A. Kitzhoffer, M.D. for the Department of Corrections. Did you copy read that, too?
Yes, sir, it does.
Oh, okay. I want to make sure. Okay, I didn't know that it's just, I highlighted, but you did read. Okay, yeah. Does this have a referral to Ways and Means?
No.
Oh, okay. That's true, the last one, too. Just things I need to know in case in this. You know, instead of four, you'd be asked different things. Yeah, I just want to highlight.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Duncan.
I find the information provided by the good senator really helpful at times.
Well, yeah. You need to highlight. I think it's very interesting.
All righty. Any objections to the motion? Hearing none. Bang. Senator Courtney.
Mr. Chair.
Anybody want to carry this?
Okay.
Senator Purdy wants to carry this.
Absolutely.
Is that okay?
Mr. Chair.
Senator Duncan, sir.
Mr. Chair, I'd like to ask unanimous consent to be allowed to vote on a bill that I had to be out of the room for just for one moment.
House Bill 2094.
2094.
Got to hang around.
Senator Duncan moved for unanimous consent to allow him to vote on House Bill 2094. Is there any objection to unanimous consent? Hearing none.
That also.
Senator Duncan.
I vote aye.
Senator Duncan votes aye on House Bill.
You might want to highlight that same language.
Yes, would you please emphasize that?
At the request of it, you might want to.
Yeah, as long as it's.
Does that mean they don't go to Ways and Means that has his name on it?
That doesn't have a Ways and Means control either, 2094, did it?
No, it doesn't. All righty, House Bill 2099.
Maybe get Chip Lassen.
His staff is in D.C., I'll tell you. Sure gonna.
All right, Chair Minutes, members of the committee, I'm here to provide information and support for House Bill 2099, which was introduced at the request of the Department of Correction. Currently, Oregon law does not allow Oregon courts to recognize pre-signed waivers of extradition from other states. As a result, when an offender from another state who has signed a waiver of extradition is arrested in Oregon, the individual must physically be taken before a judge and extradition to that state if that inmate refuses the extradition. In many states, offenders are required to sign an extradition waiver as a condition of supervision on probation, parole, and other supervised releases. Oregon official uses pre-signed waivers as part of the process of granting Oregon probation and parolees a transfer to another state for the process supervision under the Interstate Supervision Compact. This waiver means that the offender agrees not to contest extradition to his or her home state in the event a warrant is issued for their return. Because Oregon officials do not honor pre-signed extradition waivers from other states, some states are refusing to honor pre-signed waivers signed by Oregon offenders. This requires using more costly formal extradition procedures to secure and return to these persons to Oregon. House Bill 2099 would amend Oregon's version of the Uniform Criminal Extradition Act so as to join the majority of the states that give effect both extradition waivers signed outside the presence of a judge and pre-signed extradition waivers signed by offenders from other states as a condition of supervised release. That concludes my testimony.
All right. Thank you, sir. Any questions?
Do you have any, Mr. Chair?
Senator Courtney.
Do you know how many other states are? You said we joined other states. Do you know the number? Or can you? I'm not sure. If you don't know, Mr.
I'm not sure. I know it's over 20 is what
Thank
I'm
you,
hearing.
Mr. Omenica. I didn't mean to upset you.
All right. Thank you. Ingrid, you signed up?
Oh, God, Ingrid, God.
Ingrid's on this one.
No, she's not on this one. She's a candidate.
That's what I mean. That's what I mean. I assume that.
You didn't sign whether you supported or didn't.
I know I didn't. Okay. Mr. Chair, members of the committee, Ingrid Swenson, Oregon Criminal Defense Lawyers Association. And I actually just spoke with Jeff von Valkenburg prior to the hearing today and obtained more information than I had before about the intent of this measure. I think on behalf of my members, the two concerns they would have would be, number one, in item C on line 22, it would appear to authorize procedures which the legislature never contemplated in terms of mechanisms for returning prisoners from one place to another. The state of the law currently basically says that waivers, the understanding is that waivers have to comply with section 133.843. So if you adopt item C, then you think this is not exclusive. It doesn't say what else might be available, and presumably that'll be set forth somewhere else, but it wouldn't have to be legislatively approved. Secondly, I have no difficulty with people who go to another jurisdiction with the consent of that jurisdiction and are placed on probation there and supervised in that other jurisdiction, with requiring that those people indeed sign an agreement to come back voluntarily. It doesn't make sense to have to process them with a warrant and so forth. My only discomfort with this piece of it is that I would like to see a court looking at this information rather than a correctional officer or police officer. If the court were to examine the supposed waiver that the person had executed upon going to another jurisdiction, that seems like an appropriate court kind of function. And it, the bill does provide that the law enforcement agency has to have an authenticated copy of the prior waiver, signed by the person, photographs, fingerprints, or other evidence properly identifying the person. It's just that those functions seem to be ones that are appropriate for a court. So an approach that would incorporate a participation by the court in this decision would could nevertheless recognize that you don't need a governor's warrant so long as, and even if the person says, I don't care, I want to fight extradition, if the court were to find that there was a valid waiver, then I think you should take away the option of the
which court. Court are we talking about?
Any here? Court.
The courts of another state?
No, I'm talking about the courts of Oregon.
All right.
So talking about people in this jurisdiction who have been demanded by another jurisdiction to return them.
I see. Those who are in our state, who another state are asking that they be brought back.
Mm-hmm.
And you're suggesting
that's a bad idea, isn't it?
Jeff, can you shed some light on this for us?
Yes. Thank you. Chairman, members of the committee, Jeff Van Valkenburg. Here, the problem is, as Nick Armenicus stated, that two problems. One, back in the 50s, the AG's office provided an opinion that said that we had to go before an Oregon judge to make these waivers effective. The reason was that in 1937, when the legislature here in Oregon adopted this Uniform Criminal Extradition Act, they left out this language. And Oregon, to my knowledge, is the only state that did, and I researched it. The other concern is that, as a practical matter, more and more states are not honoring pre-signed waivers from Oregon because we can't honor theirs. So the department has come to me and said, what can we do about it? What I advise them is, let's use the same language that the other states have used. It's a uniform act. It's important that, that legislatures use uniform language when we have a uniform act because the courts interpret them uniformly. And that's what we want.
All right. Now, to the point that Ingrid's making about a judicial process, for people being extradited out of Oregon, are you having comments on that?
Well, Chairman, as members of the committee, what my response to that is that there are still limitations on the power of the state in proceeding that are, you know, under the state and constitution. So even though we aren't describing what these alternate procedures are, what we're really talking about is having inmates inside the facilities, both in jails and in prison, signing them outside the presence of the judge. I think it's an unnecessary step for us to preserve the rights. These folks have already signed waivers. If you want to put forward that additional protection, you certainly do so. You know, my clients certainly don't support that. What they're trying to do is to streamline this process. We're having problems in some of the counties getting the DA's office to go into court with their busy dockets to handle this caseload. So that's the problem that we're trying to address.
All right.
Thank you.
Questions? Work session.
I move House Bill 2099 to the Senate floor with a due pass recommendation.
Senator Courtney moves House Bill 2099 to the floor with a Senate with a due pass recommendation. Discussion with Senator Brink.
Chairman, I will only vote for this bill if Senator Duncan is allowed to carry it.
Why? Why should he be allowed to carry it as opposed to anyone else carry it?
It's very
Duncan-esque.
Because I like the idea of something that's uniform being carried out uniformly.
Imagine the idea.
Well, you definitely don't want to go.
Okay. Any further discussion? Any objections? Senator Duncan will carry the bill.
Thank you, thank you, thank you. I'm excited.
You are? Good.
Let's see where. 2100, are we?
Yes, House Bill 2100. Public hearing.
We're just rocking home. We've got 15 minutes left, so we've got to get to 2040, 3049. You want to jam down the day.
The dash two that has incorporated and
well, that's
a good right.
What's wrong with Tuesday?
Oh, wait a minute. Excuse me.
I just have to get my vice chair on the right track here.
Yeah, I'm fine.
See, there's something about Constitution.
That's a difficult task. Scott, go right ahead, sir.
Chair Minnis, members of the committee, I'm Scott Taylor, Department of Corrections. I'm here to provide information in support of House Bill 2100, which was introduced to Department of Corrections. At the current time, we have roughly 300 inmates a month that complete their prison sentence and are released into Oregon communities. Oregon's 30% rate of recidivism, and that is former inmates with new felony conviction within 3 years is how I'm defining that, is among the lowest in the United States, but the highest failure rate occurs within the first year of release from prison. In keeping with the Department's mission of holding offenders accountable for their actions and reducing the risk of that future criminal behavior, we started a transition project that we've talked to many of you about over time. As the steering committee looked at that, went through the different steps and the ways we might improve that, one of the issues that came to light was the need for a seamless flow from incarceration to the community. And to make that more effective, the department and the community tried to work out ways that we could hold people more accountable, make sure they got where they were going when they were released in a way that we could have a support and monitoring. Under current law, inmates and offenders scheduled release from a correctional facility on a weekend or legal holiday may be released on weekday before the actual release date, which is often Friday. From August 99 through January 2000, we released 33% of the releasing population on a Friday, more than any other day of the week. Releasing an offender on a Friday can create unnecessary obstacles and lead to a setup for failure. In the written testimony, I provide a little example of a person getting out of prison, arriving in a southern Oregon county. By the time they get on the bus and get there, it's Friday late evening. The ability to connect up with not only their parole officer, but the other social services may not occur until the next week. What we looked at in this bill is the ability to expand that releasing day by 2 days, so allowing us to release people on Wednesday, Thursday, or Friday prior to their official release date, and allowing us to then work with the counties and the local government in the releasing of that individual, so that they can arrive there in time to make sure that things are taken care of before that Friday evening. We do not anticipate this bill being used for everybody. We anticipate it being used for, as we work out the plans for the individual, those people that are actually going the furthest distance on a bus or those people who need to be locked into treatment programs or something else, and making sure that we have a schedule set up that we can actually comply with. We have before you, I believe, the -2 amendments. After this bill was introduced, we looked at both the Denny Smith Initiative, Measure 4, and Measure 11, just to make sure that this bill allows for that type of action on those two populations. At this time, we have about 556 Measure 4 inmates housed with us in the Department of Corrections, and that's what the -2 was. In the initial, we had not taken into account the Denny Smith Initiative.
Mr. Chair.
Senator Harper.
If we really cared about these people, we'd just hold them over the weekend and let them out on Tuesday.
Can't do it.
Chairman, Senator Harper, because of Measure 11 and a specific release date, we are not allowed to hold them any longer than their specific max date.
We don't really care.
We're up to the Harper Hotel.
You want the -2 amendments, right?
Actually,
what do we, are there other amendments?
There's 2100-1, which I didn't provide. You may explain what.
No, they've got it. What's that?
Which is right here. Also says you can't abridge the items.
Okay.
So they wanted that involved.
Just one on Friday.
You got a chair here.
We're in the Blossom Dance. The Blossom Dance in the Minda.
I'm going to be in a brief recess. Looking up the
37. We are going to close public hearing, 2100, and we're adjourned.
Okay. That's it.